I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, we discuss accessibility to mental health services. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, an estimated 26% of Americans age 18 and older struggle with a diagnosable mental disorder in a given year. One in 17 struggle with more serious mental illness. Joining us to talk about better access to mental health services is Ron Holmes, Executive Director of NAMI Cape Cod and the Islands, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Good morning.
Good morning.
We also have with us Liz Kelly, Nurse Manager of the Emergency Center. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Diane Wolsifer, Psychiatric Nurse Practitioner at the Cape Cod Health Center ER. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Ron, let's start first with what NAMI is, because I think there might be some people who aren't familiar with that organization.
Sure. Well, as you said, NAMI stands for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. It is a national organization based in Arlington, Virginia, and we are the affiliate for Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket. We've been around since 1982, and we are mostly an educational, information, referral resource. So NAMI actually got started back in 1979. The national organization was founded because family members of people with mental illness did not really have much in the way of resources. And so that was its origin. And it's why our kind of flagship course today is family-to-family education. It's a 12-week course that teaches family members about mental illnesses and their medications. But also talks about empathy for their loved one, communication skills, coping skills, a little bit of self-care for the family member, which can be very important. So, again, it's a 12-week course. All of our programming is free, and we try to educate people that way because we do believe that through that education, better understanding will result, and from better understanding, we'll have less stigma.
Right. Do you also advocate, you know, legislatively as well?
Advocacy as well. The three words that kind of sum up what NAMI does is support, educate, and advocate. Mm-hmm. So we have support groups both for family members and for people with mental illness. We do advocacy work as well. Mm-hmm. The NAMI Massachusetts, of which we're an affiliate as well, is heavily involved with advocacy work at the state level. And locally, a couple of years ago when the issue of closing Taunton State Hospital was a big issue, we took a stand on that and petitioned the legislators to keep the hospital open, and I'm happy to say we were successful with that.
Yeah. All right. This past week, mental health care providers came together for what was called Cape Cod's first Behavioral Health Summit. All right, so what prompted the summit? I know, Diane and Liz, you two were involved in this, so what prompted it?
Well, I think that Liz and I both noticed that we were having patients come to the ER quite frequently, many times repeated admissions to the ER, even after being hospitalized, and it was hard to see any noticeable improvement in their quality of life. So we thought that if we could get the providers together, we could really serve the patients better in offering a more wraparound services to the adult population, because our children's population does have a wraparound program.
Mm-hmm. Explain what a wraparound program is.
Well, it's a strength-based program where providers and maybe people involved in the school system meet with the families, and they develop a strength-based plan to guide the children along and learn coping skills mm-hmm. for their mental illness at an early age.
Mm-hmm. So this was sent out basically to, if you're a mental health care provider, we want you all to come to this and get together. Is that the idea, and see who's doing what? Was that sort of what was behind this?
Yeah, we brought together some of the bigger agencies, such as the Department of Mental Health, Duffy Healthcare Center,
Gosnold.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, and it was, from what I understand, pretty well attended. You sold out, right? So
we
there's
sold
obviously
out.
A lot of
yeah.
people interested in this.
Yeah.
So, what is there any kind of consensus that came from this? Did you all come up with here's where we need to go next?
Well, we did have a survey. Pat Colley from Duffy developed a survey, and we all had input. And hopefully many participants at the summit, and even some that didn't attend the summit, will be able to fill it out and submit it. We're going to have all that data input and review that for an October 24th meeting, where we hope to invite more providers to come to the table and see what the consensus is of the needs. But some of the things I think that we got right away were that people were really hopeful that this could, you know, this initiative could improve care and decrease the frustration that I think a lot of providers have in seeing that their patients aren't getting better and that there's less and less resources.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned both, Diane and Liz, you both see patients who you say are repeat. They come back and you don't see much change in the care. Are we talking, I mean, is this pretty common? I mean, is that the majority of the people you keep coming back through? Is that a common theme you're seeing?
I think that there's a percentage of the population, and I'm not really sure what that is. I think a lot of people are being successful in navigating the system well.
But there's a small group that may not be having
They might not have the family supports that the others have. Mm-hmm.
So the idea here is to create a crisis system of care then? Is that what's coming out of this?
We're, among other things, I think we're hoping to move in that direction. It's pretty complex.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what, Ron, maybe the question for you, what are some of the common types of mental illness that we're seeing in our region? I'm sure it's the same as everywhere else, right?
Well, it's a pretty wide spectrum, actually, Mindy. And we like to say we're all on it to some degree.
Right.
Anything,
I think we are. Yeah.
Of course we are. Yeah. Everything from mild depression all the way through schizophrenia and some of the more serious mental illnesses, certainly the mood disorders and psychotic disorders, they're all on there. Mm-hmm. And we find people are more willing these days to open up about having these illnesses in their family, and a great many families do have them. And so we think that there's a real need for bringing this out into the open more, and that's why we try to do the educational courses that we do, and speak to groups about this. But going back to the summit for just a minute, you asked about what came out of that, and I think that one of the real pleasurable parts for those of us that worked on it, that were on the steering committee, was that there was a real energy in the room. So all of those providers were in the room and came away with something that not only did they hear some good speakers and some good panelists, but they were, I think, happy and interested to see that something was being done to try to bring this provider community together, which was part of the impetus of doing it, was to bring all those providers together to address in some way the fragmentation and in some ways the confusion that exists in the mental health care system. And I think we accomplished that, at least from getting people motivated anyway to try to do more about it.
How about networking? Do you find
big,
a lot of people?
Big part of it. Yeah.
Right. Our one of our social workers in the emergency room came, and she came out with lots of pamphlets. I'm sure she reunited with some colleagues that she hadn't seen in some time as well. And she, she was talking about South Bay Mental Health, some programs she wasn't aware of. Mm-hmm. And we frequently refer to South Bay Mental Health.
Yeah. So. That's one of the things I think would be frustrating from a provider's point of view is you're so in the trenches, you're really involved in what you're doing and not really maybe knowing what somebody else is doing. And that may be part where people get a little lost in the system. They know about, I can go to the ER, but they may not know about some other program that's somewhere else. Right?
Right.
Yeah. Right. What's the Purple Zone, Liz?
Well, the Purple Zone is a 9-bed area that we set aside in the ER. And that has been running for about 2 years now. It came about because I would say back as long ago as the end of 2008, beginning of 2009, we started seeing more patients with mental illness and substance abuse issues. And they started sticking around longer. Mm-hmm. An ER is set up for a 2-hour visit, 3-hour visit. You want to be in and out. So when people are stuck there for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 hours, it gets very uncomfortable for them.
Mm-hmm. So you set this area aside. And so these be folks that you are maybe transferring somewhere else or that need a psychiatric bed somewhere? Is that what we're talking about?
That we're hoping to transfer someone out somewhere else. We're waiting for a bed to open up.
All right. So you said hoping. Is there? I'm assuming that means there aren't enough beds always available.
There are not enough beds. We wait days, sometimes weeks, for the right bed to open for a patient. And that has gotten worse and worse over the years. Back in 2009, when we started noticing this problem, for example, in June, we had 200 patients who we had to board, and they stayed an average of 12 hours And in August of this August, there were more like almost 400 patients who needed to stay about 24 hours on average.
So is there a time limit that they can stay in this purple zone? Or no,
there's no time limit. Yeah. It's until...
Until a bed becomes available.
Or sometimes they go home. Sometimes they're there so long we're able to manage with some of their medications and get them well enough, get some supports in place so they can go home with some outpatient follow-up.
Yeah. Is the part of the problem with the not having enough beds available that we have fewer beds, or is it just the need is greater? I mean, what's happening that we're not able to find enough beds?
Well, there are fewer beds. Mm-hmm. Taunton closed some beds, and it's not that we send people to Taunton, but the people who are in Taunton, who were in Taunton, need some lower levels of care, such as Pocasset. We have 20 beds at Cape Psych, and they are that's a Cape Psychiatric Center that's on the Cape Cod Hospital campus. They have 20 beds, and they are 98% occupied all the time.
So now, as we mentioned, as Ron was talking a few minutes ago, you've got a wide range here of potential patients, but I would imagine that what you're seeing in the ER would be more serious or more escalating cases, right, most of the time? Is that what you're seeing in the ER?
I think we do see people that are quite desperate and often quite acute, but a lot of times people just might say off the top of their head, you know, or they might be having a bad time and say that I wish I was dead or I could shoot myself, and they get sent to the ER as well, and we have to sort out, make sure they, you know, they don't have a history or they don't have, you know, they have the supports that they need around them. Yeah. So
I would imagine that's a little bit time consuming too, because you're trying to find out if somebody really is suicidal or not. How serious, you know, where they are in whatever, you know, episode they're going through. So do you have a big enough, I mean, how big is your staff to take the time to do all of that?
It's basically just me and the social worker, and then we have our psychiatric assessment team, which is on call and usually can respond within a couple of hours. We also have the Department of Mental Health, which has more difficulty coming to the ER quickly. So they might wait like 8 hours to be evaluated. Mm-hmm. And that's usually for the cases that we really are concerned about.
Mm-hmm. So this purple zone, in a lot of ways, gives you the opportunity to sort of monitor what's happening with these patients then.
Keep them safe.
Yeah.
It does. I wonder, too, if people are coming for help more than they used to. Mm-hmm. And that's not a bad thing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's really not a bad thing.
Right, exactly. We're talking about accessibility to mental health services, and we're going to open up the phone lines, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a short break.
Oh, we're on the beach that's also part of Cedar Tree Neck with Vineyard Sound in front of us. And right across from us, you can see a strip of beach and a lighthouse that's called Tarpaulin Cove on Nauchon Island. And back in the 1800s, this was an extremely important and busy thoroughfare for sailing vessels and commerce going from New York to Boston.
That's Eric Kipp of Edgartown.
So they had to wait for the tide, and they would often go into Tarpaulin Cove, where there was actually a hotel, and I'm told a brothel to boot. And they would also stay in Vineyard Haven, the old postcards of ships in waiting for the tides, just packed with masts and ships. During that time, the ships had to pass from New York through Long Island Sound, and then again into Vineyard Sound, pass through Nantucket Sound, and go all the way out through the Nantucket Shoals, around Cape Cod, and back into Boston. This was all at the time before the Cape Cod Canal was built, which was around 1913, 1914, was even proposed back as early as the late 17th century, 1670 or something. So it was obviously a problem. There were many wrecks of these boats trying to get around Cape Cod to Boston.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking about accessibility to mental health services with Ron Holmes, Executive Director of NAMI Cape Cod and the Islands, Diane Wolsifer, psychiatric nurse practitioner at Cape Cod Health Health Center ER and Liz Kelly, nurse manager of the emergency center. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I don't know who wants to talk about this, but trauma-informal care for clients and providers? Tell us about that.
Trauma-informed care, we had Katie Volk come from T3. She has trained people at throughout the community to have an understanding of what happens to someone who's gone through a trauma, a psychological trauma. A lot of times, quite young ages, children see violence or experience violence in some way, and it changes. It actually changes the way they think and their how they cope with crisis going throughout their life. So you might be talking to somebody in the ER, and they might be experiencing re-experiencing a trauma by just seeing what's going on in a busy ER, and they can't even think to answer your questions mm-hmm. because their alert system, the amygdala in the brain, is on alert.
Mm. It almost sounds a little bit like post-traumatic stress disorder, kind of.
Exactly.
And this also for providers, in a sense that providers sometimes, when they're hearing all of these stories, they can have some of this trauma as well.
Yes,
or traumatic-like, I guess, experience.
Yes, I can remember working at Duffy, for instance. Sometimes you hear many, many stories in one day, and by the end of the day, you're just totally spent. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to pay attention to that and take care of yourself. And that's one thing I think that the summit really shows, that feeling that there are other people out there that are also hearing these stories. I think it shows us ways of dealing with it and sharing the stories or sharing our story so that we can provide better care and feel more whole in that role.
Yeah. Of course, mental illness affects more than the person who suffers from it. Obviously, it impacts families and friends and sometimes your provider, depending on how many people that person has seen in that day. So Ron, that kind of goes back to looking at this, the families. We're talking about the providers hearing these stories, and the end of the day, as Diana's saying, feel kind of spent. Families go through something similar because, this is day in and day out, and some days are better than other days, but it's sort of like this road you're on that can be really tough.
Absolutely, and journey is the word that most family members use for the road that they're on. So it can be very difficult, and that's why, as I mentioned earlier in the family-to-family class, we do stress self-care for family members. It can be very important. Some of the situations that family members have to deal with when they have a loved one with mental illness can be very difficult, particularly if that person is living in their household. Behaviors can get out of hand. We talk about limit setting in the course because it doesn't have to be that you just accept anything and everything from the ill person. But we really stress that empathy because it does help family members. And by the way, when I say family members, we mean that as a broad term.
Right.
That's very broad and can include friends and family members of any type. So when they're trying to face that situation, it helps them handle that in a way that that is more caring if they understand what their loved one has gone through or is going through at the time. Their behaviors could be a result of many of the issues that they've had to deal with, maybe some failings, maybe some low self-esteem, and they tried certain things, it didn't work. It could be medication side effects. It could be all kinds of things. And yet, it's so easy for us to approach something with our own mind without thinking about what it is for the other person's mind. What are they dealing with? And you mentioned earlier about PTSD, and we do associate post-traumatic stress disorder too readily with the military. But trauma is trauma, and it can be anywhere, and even for children, that they could have a trauma that they're dealing with that is affecting their behavior. And so that's something that, that needs to be looked at as well.
We've talked about this when we have the doctors on, Dr. Whaley and Dr. Abrazzese, where we talked about this building up of trauma. You know, something happens and it might not be that particular incident that really sort of sends you over the edge. It's sort of this building block of other traumas that you've been through, and sort of like the straw on the camel's back. So I think you bring up a good point, Ron, about the empathy, trying to put yourself in that other person's shoes and ask yourself, well, why? You know, what is the, you know, diagnosis, but you know what might be going on inside their head that's making them act or react like
this. It's really helpful, and that's a I don't want to say a fun class, but it is gratifying when you, for the leaders of that course to when they do that class, because there is very much an aha moment for the participants in the class to when they get that, because they haven't really thought about it before, and then they start to feel guilty and blame themselves, and we don't allow that. We don't allow guilt or blame. We are there to educate, and right. you can't know what no one ever told you is one of our lines, right. but we don't allow that. But there is kind of a light bulb moment there.
Yeah, let's say you can always go forward. You can't change what's been in the past, but you can always change
exactly
with
right.
how you react in the future. All right, so this might be a good time to bring up the stigma question. It's Ron, you and I were talking before we went on the air. It seems like there's less stigma, but it's still there.
Oh, it's still there, absolutely. I think that we are making some progress. I'm happy to say, and I don't think I'm kidding myself, that as we go about our business, myself and Liz and Diane and all the other people in the mental health community, I think that that we do sense a momentum that's happening, and I think that there's more and more talking about this, mm-hmm. and the more it's out there, the less stigma there will be. And let's face it, stigma is just a fear, and fear of the unknown. Mm-hmm. So if people understand mental illness more, it's not brushed under the rug or just, oh, we don't talk about that, mm-hmm. That kind of an approach, then I think that we will make some progress. And it's very important to have parents of children and adolescents to understand this and start to address these things if there is something to address, mm-hmm. At a much earlier age. We are so convinced that the earlier intervention is going to be so key to going forward for that generation and the ones after it. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we have a course that's just geared towards parents or other caregivers of children and adolescents.
I know a lot of doctors' offices, hospitals, community health centers are now sort of asking questions that they never asked before about mental health. What's your experience, I know, or Liz, on the stigma? Do you have people, you know, expressing that? Or are they reluctant to answer your question?
Well, we're required to ask every patient coming into the emergency center if you are feeling like you might hurt yourself or if someone else maybe hurting you in your home. So we're screening for suicidality and domestic violence. And this is a relatively new thing. And some of the nurses were uncomfortable saying, you know what, I don't want to ask people that. That might make them think that they are, you know, suicidal, or, you know, it might be embarrassing for them. But we've gotten used to it and we're doing it. And speaking of stigma and trauma and those kind of topics, when we started seeing the explosion in the need for mental health care in the ER, the patient is traumatized coming to the ER. Anybody's traumatized coming to the ER. If someone comes to you and says, you look really sick, you better go to the ER, right away, your adrenaline's up, you're like, ooh.
Yeah.
So, no, and even more so with mental illness, they're having a crisis out in the community, and people are saying, you know, maybe you called your therapist and said, you know, I can't cope, and they say, go to the ER. Mm-hmm. So now you're traumatized coming in the door, and then we put you in a hallway bed where everybody's looking at you and saying, well, he doesn't look really sick. I wonder what he's here for. Mm-hmm. And we might have someone sitting watching you, just sitting there staring at you. It's not a really warm and fuzzy experience at all.
Yeah.
So the Purple Zone was also designed to help mitigate some of that trauma.
Help people feel a little more comfortable. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think to talk about stigma and primary care, one of the national initiatives is to bring mental health care to the primary care office. I think that will help. It will make it more mainstream that people do deal with depression and anxiety fairly frequently.
Mm-hmm. A lot more than I think we realize, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And another initiative that might help with the stigma is the peer recovery program, which we have a pretty strong program in our area. And these are people with lived experience who have learned to deal with their illness and realize that there are periods of recovery. It's episodic. And it's just, they were part of a panel at our summit, and it was just wonderful to hear their stories and their resilience.
Yeah. So, yeah, Ron, you mentioned that to me, that you were really impressed by that panel discussion. Tell us about it.
It was very powerful. Pat Durgan, who is the manager of the partial hospital program over at Cape Psych, she led a panel of people in recovery who just did an excellent job, and they spoke very openly about their experiences with stigma and the use of certain words. One of the panelists even used the word stupid as something that was referred to them as, and but other things, even just things that people wouldn't even think about, that maybe they were talked about by a couple of professionals as if they weren't even there. Other references that that just made them feel like second-class citizens, not exactly esteem builders for mm-hmm. people maybe already having some low self-esteem. So it was very powerful, and I really applaud those people on that panel. They not only spoke openly, but very very caringly, in the sense of they want to see things improve as well, and they put themselves out there to do it.
It's a brave thing to do.
It really was.
In front of a crowd like that. I was telling you, I thought the same thing when I read Kitty Dukakis's book,
yes.
where she talked about her battles, and I thought, wow, you know, a public figure like that, and she was so honest. And if you haven't read that book, it's really worth reading. I wish I could remember the name of it right now. Maybe Jenny can look that up for us. But I mean, there is it's a brave thing to do, to get out there and say. But I think that those stories also help reduce the stigma.
They absolutely do.
Yeah. If you'd like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right. So one of the problems we see, and this is not just us nationally, we're seeing fewer people opting for a career as a psychiatrist or we have residencies we can't fill. Any ideas, any thoughts on why? I mean, why we're seeing fewer people enter that field? Has it got to do with insurance and pay and all of that, or is it something else?
Well, we're all jumping right
on
that one.
Yeah. No. I'm not sure if it might be financially driven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's a long time in school, right? You've got a lot of college bills for that, and then
and then the way I think that we have had psychiatrists have had to practice in the past. I don't know, decade. I think it's been very medication oriented. They, you know, the insurance companies have kind of dictated that it's more financially prudent to medicate people than spend time counseling them. But I, on the other hand, it's easier to prove that medication works than it is to prove that counseling works. It's mm-hmm. I think the evidence is hard to. There's so many variables in a counseling relationship where you have the medication, you don't have the medication. It's much easier in studies to prove mm-hmm. that medication works.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yes. I was going to say, I'm not sure if this is really part of it or not, but I do know, anecdotally, I suppose, from the family members that we speak to, that they get frustrated mm-hmm. because their loved one gets the wrong diagnosis a number of times, gets put on the wrong medication a number of times. And this is difficult. This is very difficult. And even psychiatrists will say this is very difficult. And I had one say that what he likes to say is, give me four tries to get this right. Mm-hmm. It's not the same as going in and diagnosing for cancer or something else. This is as complex as the brain is complex. Right. And psychiatrists, as good as they are, they don't understand it all. We've made tremendous strides in the last even just 30, 40 years. Where we are today compared to to 1980 is like night and day. Mm-hmm. So we are making tremendous strides. But I can't help but wonder if some of that frustration with being able to do things effectively or as effectively as they would like has some mm-hmm. bearing on the choices of what medicine to go into. Not mm-hmm. sure.
So what do we do? You know, when you don't have a psychiatrist there to manage the meds, you've got somebody else has got to do that, right? I mean, so where there's, how many psychiatrists do we have at Cape Cod Health Center? And probably could use more than we have, right?
At the psych center, we have two, and then I believe on the weekends they have locums come, and we have I think two at Cape Cod Human Services, mm-hmm. and then there are nurse practitioners who practice under the psychiatrist. Mm-hmm.
So psychiatrists sort of oversee that. And then but are we seeing more clinicians? I mean, kind of are we seeing is where the psychiatrists, you know, we're not seeing as many people going into that field. Are we seeing others in the field sort of filling in the gaps? I don't know if that question makes sense.
I'm not sure.
Not sure. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So you don't struggle with that then? I know some areas, some community health centers have had real struggles with that.
Oh, I think we do struggle with it, yes, because it's very difficult for a person to get in to see a psychiatrist if mm-hmm. they haven't already established a relationship. Mm-hmm. So it might take a month to 6 weeks to 2 months.
Which is, if you're in the middle of a crisis, that's tough. So that's, Liz, I guess what you see in the purple zone. You've got people there who are having a crisis now. You're trying to find them a bed. They may or may not have a doctor that they can get in to see, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. How frustrating.
Yeah. That is part of the problem. You know, we get those calls at NAMI of people in crisis or perhaps approaching a crisis and they don't know what to do. And because there isn't a good number of people for them to see, they do end up in the ER, and that mm-hmm. complicates their problem.
Yeah. So how do we keep people from not ending up in the ER? I know it's a complicated problem and there isn't, you know, one answer to all of our problems here. But as you know, family members, if you can sometimes see that a crisis is building, or maybe you can feel it yourself, you know, you're you know, whatever mm-hmm. you're being diagnosed, you can sense it's coming on. Is there other things we can do to prevent a trip to the ER?
Well, I'd hate to say don't come to the ER if you're feeling like you're in a crisis, that's where we want you to be. I guess I'm feeling that we need to have just a more coordinated network of community providers to be able to disposition somebody to a really supportive environment. More than go inpatient, because I feel that inpatient many times is just a quick adjustment of medications and then stabilization and then return to the community with not really mm-hmm. solving any problems. Yeah. You know?
So really the key here is the support once you're out in your daily life.
And I think the support before you have to go to the ER, I think the pediatric mobile crisis team has been very, very successful with the kids. Mm-hmm. And we've noticed since they've been in action, fewer pediatric patients coming to the ER. And when they do come, the crisis team comes to meet them and gets them a placement or gets them the support they need. But a lot of times they can give the support they need and the crisis doesn't happen.
Gotcha. So, and this is sort of what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, which is where we're trying to go with the adult services now, is more based on this model that we're using with the pediatric
Correct.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Rebecca is giving us a call. Good morning, Rebecca.
Oh, good morning. This is Rebecca. I'm actually a psychologist. I've been head of St. Louis Children's Hospital psychology program for years. I'm retired on the Cape now. And I just wanted to kind of counter the notion that it's difficult to prove that psychotherapy kind of works. And there's a really good recent article in the New York Times, September 29th, by Brandon Gaudiano, who talks about that psychotherapy has an image problem, mm-hmm. that primary care people don't really know that there's a huge level of research support that shows that psychotherapy is effective in many cases, and particularly for years there's been a huge amount of research showing that psychotherapy plus meds for things like depression is really the most effective treatment. And I think that I think it's really important to say that because what psychotherapy gives people are behavioral skills that last a lifetime, and that's something that one can't get from straight meds.
Right.
So, you know, and I think the reason, you know, we need to say this over and over again is that managed care companies push meds because mm-hmm. it's quick and, you know, relatively cheap. But that's not necessarily the most effective treatment for people.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point, Rebecca. And also there are some people that meds, they want that. I mean, obviously there are certain situations you need meds, but sometimes there are people who say, can I try something else first? I don't want to take medications.
And I think that meds, I mean, if we think about something like depression, meds help you get your mood up, which is very important, but that opens you up to now needing to say, how do I change my thoughts about mm-hmm. events that happened? How do I change my reactions? And that is not going to come from meds. Mm-hmm. That's going to come from psychotherapy or, you know, some kind of behavioral skill work. And so when we give people meds alone, they get their mood up, and then they want to change, and they're given no mechanism for change if they're not given the opportunity for something like psychotherapy. So I think we really need mental health professionals to continue to, you know, negotiate with managed care companies on behalf of getting funding for right. psychotherapy in addition to meds.
Rebecca, thanks for the call, and your thoughts, they're good ones. Let's talk about insurance. I'm seeing some looks here. The insurance companies, I mean, it's true what she says, right? I mean, it's easier to get the meds than it is to get some of the other services.
It's one of my, let me say this. If the ER was full of patients with pneumonia every morning, if we had 10 patients in the ER every morning with pneumonia who couldn't find a hospital bed to get treated, I think the national government and the CDC, everybody would be all over that.
Right.
So why do we have 10 mentally ill people in the ER every morning that
good
can't
point.
Find a bed?
Yeah, very good point.
They really are dictating the care. They're the gatekeepers of the bed situation. And I do agree with the caller in that psychotherapy is important and learning coping skills for life in general is very important.
Mm-hmm. All right, Ron, going to the advocacy part, what do you do about that? I mean, the insurance companies are dictating what we're doing here.
Yeah, thanks for throwing that at me.
But, I mean, obviously it's not something you can do alone, but it's something people need to be aware of. I mean,
as
a citizenry.
It is. You know, coming back to that summit for just a minute, we were happy with that the providers came away with such an energy and kind of an optimism for doing something in our community. But so many aspects of mental health care goes beyond just even your local community. We are talking about a system of care that can be at the state and national levels. It can even be societal. You know, how are we going to approach this? What are we going to do for folks that do suffer from mental illness? And I agree with the caller too. It has to be some psychotherapy involved with that. It can't just all be medications. And if that's the quick fix, she makes a good point too. That yes, the medications get you to a certain point, and then what? Then where do you go? So the whole care system needs to be improved. And what are we going to do as a society, as a country, to try to provide this in a better way? And I think hopefully that that if there is more understanding of this, more awareness of the lack of care, and I don't mean lack of care, I mean the room for improvement in this mm-hmm. care, then maybe we can get something going. It's not going to happen overnight, but big things start with little steps.
Right. Kathleen, who works with Grandmothers Against Gun Violence, .org called. She wants to ask if the healthcare workers are able to find a way to bring up the topic of guns as they ask these difficult questions. She points out that 2/3 of all gun deaths in the country are suicides. Yeah, that goes back to the question of screening. Everybody
I think that's
comes
part
in.
Of our evaluation is access to means.
Mm-hmm.
And guns are the most lethal.
Yeah. It is true, and I actually spoke to the Grandmothers Against Gun Violence and was asked the question of when we do our family-to-family course, can something be said about are the guns secure? If you have guns in your house, are they secure? And I thought about that, and I agreed with that, and we have worked that into our course. There is on the part about limit setting. I think it's a fair question, not a question, a fair statement to say, setting the whole gun issue aside, if you have guns in your house, are they secure? It was that simple. Mm-hmm. Because it is something about limiting that access.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Now, it would seem there's a need, a big need for outpatient services, but I understand they're actually declining. Why? Is it funding?
I think it is funding. I think agencies in our community are struggle to keep open, mm-hmm. To keep up with the mandated paperwork and computer systems necessary, pay their employees, pay benefits, and keep the place open.
Hmm. Well, most agencies are losing money. I think we heard at the summit 85% of the agencies in Massachusetts that provide behavioral health care lose money. Cape Cod Healthcare loses money on behavioral health. So that's got to change. We're supposed to have parity in the state of Massachusetts for mental health care. We do not.
Mm-hmm. We do not. So what are your thoughts on that, Ron?
Well, I think that in some cases, it's looking at things like managed cost instead of managed care, as was suggested at the summit, and talking about the costs involved and looking at the bottom line. These are sometimes spoken as if they're evil. Mm-hmm. There's lots of room for improvement in this area, but I think that any organization that is losing money is not going to be around for very long. Mm-hmm. It's just a necessary part of it that we have to be able to cover costs. And so some business approach to it, I think that there's room for some business approach in the whole scheme of it.
Yeah. Well, and you probably know this better than anybody when you're advocating for families. A lot of these families are tired. You know, they don't really have the energy to do a lot of the advocating for themselves that, you know, on any other issue somebody might. So do you think that's part of the problem, too, is that you know, we're not hearing from these families as much as we maybe could be if they weren't so tired?
could very well be. It is very tiring. It's wearying. Yeah. That we hear this from the people that have this in their families. It is a tremendous effort that it takes to get through all this, not just to sometimes care for their loved one, but to deal with all of the agencies, and whether maybe they're applying for SSI, maybe they're trying to be enrolled with the Department of Mental Health, DMH, maybe they're trying to find housing for their loved one. Maybe there's an unending list of issues that they have to address.
And that paperwork and every single one of those issues is overwhelming.
Overwhelming. It's not
Why can't
fun
we make
thing.
It easier? You know,
no, it becomes a full-time job.
It is.
It's overwhelming for the providers. Yeah, and they talk about having these multi-page computerized intake forms that take hours to get through with someone who's suffering. Mm-hmm. And I think we heard about one provider who said, who let the client go out and take a break and get something to eat and come back and finish the intake form.
Wow.
You know,
yeah.
It is overwhelming.
Yeah. What about this trend of including the behavior part of your team, you know, this team approach we've been talking about, you know, the mind and spirit whole thing. Are we seeing that becoming any kind of a reality where the behavior, you know, what's happening behaviorally is part of your whole team approach?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Patient-centered, a medical home.
Oh, Vic DeGravio, who was at our summit and spoke about barriers to healthcare, behavioral healthcare, and barriers to getting reimbursed for behavioral healthcare, was talking about the initiative that I mentioned earlier to integrate behavioral health care into primary care. And one problem, I think it was the Department of Public Health, had mandated that there be separate waiting rooms for somebody with a behavioral health problem and then a medical problem. Well, the reason they did that was to protect, actually, the behavioral health person's rights to privacy. But that becomes a difficulty for the medical office.
Sure.
And primary care is also struggling to...
Do you feel like it seems to me, at least in the primary care offices I've been into, it seems like they are taking a little more of that approach. Maybe not everybody, but they are asking those questions that never were asked before. I know I'm asked questions like, what are you doing for the stress? My doctor never asked. I mean, 10 years ago, they wouldn't even think of asking something like that or handing me out some yoga exercises. That isn't something that we saw before. So I'm just wondering if you all get the feeling as well that there's an effort from some primary care physicians anyway to try to integrate those other aspects.
Definitely. A lot of people came up and spoke to me individually during the summit that they were glad that this happened. Kate Rudman, a pediatrician on the Cape, is active on our committee and has encouraged other physicians to come to the summit. And because that's, as she puts it, that's where the patients show up with their...
That's the first sign.
Right.
Yeah. And I would imagine, like with anything else, you get it early, you have a better chance of keeping under control, right?
That's part of the momentum we were feeling, is that the feeling of integration, of less and less stigma, of people looking for help at an earlier stage instead of, shoving it under the table and say, well, this can't be. We're not going to go there. Mm-hmm. To be able to talk to your primary care physician or your pediatrician about possible mental health concerns or substance abuse concerns, mm-hmm. maybe in your young teenager, right. That's huge.
Yeah,
right. It really is.
What about comorbidity? Do you find that patients often suffer from more than one diagnosis?
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. Diabetes, hypertension. Actually, some of the antipsychotic meds are known to increase your chances of having a metabolic syndrome. So, and if you have mental illness, it's tough to get your act together as far as getting to your primary care and getting your medications right and eating the correct diet, mm-hmm. and being housed and
goes back to that support thing again,
right.
Doesn't it? Yeah, yeah. What about children? I know that we talked about the children seem to have a little better system than the adults do at the moment. But it seems I was talking to a school superintendent who said that's one of the challenges in the school systems are children coming into the system, greater numbers with some pretty challenging diagnoses, which is something we hadn't seen before, 10, 20 years ago. Better diagnosis? Is that what we have going on now? Or what do you?
That's a big question also.
Yeah.
You're pretty good at that, Mindy.
About these controversial questions, right?
Well, probably better diagnosis. I mean, mm-hmm. I went to school quite a number of years ago in elementary school. I remember the bad kids that the teachers would mm-hmm. send to the principal all the time, or maybe had to sit outside the principal's office mm-hmm. for the whole day.
Oh, we're in a special class.
Class, segregated. I think it's become more and more integrated, mm-hmm. and better diagnosis. And
I think also that there's a number of things that maybe moving this along, and stress is such a huge mm-hmm. trigger for things, and kids today have so many more stressors than they used
sure.
to. So it is a lifestyle issue. I think it is more diagnosis. I think and this is a good thing. There's more awareness. Mm-hmm. There's more awareness that to pay attention to your child's behavioral issues and do something about it. Whereas at one time maybe you just didn't do much or you mm-hmm. tried to block it out. And so I think that it's a combination of all those things that we're seeing things moving in a certain direction. And really, this may sound like it's more work for everybody, but this is a good direction that we're headed in, because some school districts are actually implementing screenings, mm-hmm. Depression screenings, other screenings for behavioral issues. Again, we think that if we can get to these neurological disorders and behavioral issues at a much earlier age, that child child stands a much better mm-hmm. chance of having a better time of it later in life than they do if that's not the case. And in that family-to-family course, again, we have parents of adult children, and it could be in their 20s or 30s, but they could also be in their 40s or 50s, mm-hmm. and they've been dealing with this for decades, and, right. and they're just beginning to learn about it now. So yeah. we're trying to get to that at an earlier age.
So what's next? We had the summit. You're planning another summit, but this one for users rather than providers, users of the mental health system, right? So tell us about that.
Well, I think that's one of the big takeaways from the summit that we had on Friday, and it is something that the steering committee that brought the summit on Friday together. We that's not going to be the end of it. We want to continue this with other events, maybe even some social get-togethers for those providers. We want to continue those connections and that networking that's happening with those providers and make that that network of providers more familiar, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So I think that the next big step is that next May, Mental Health Awareness Month, we are planning a follow-up summit, as you say, for all of the users of these services that these providers are there to provide. And I think that that we'll have lectures, workshops, just a number of exhibitor tables. So people, certainly if they have mental illness in their family, that they can come and learn more about what some of the providers do. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just the general public, someone who, and we hope this is true, someone who just wants to be better informed about mental illness, that they can come and get that as well.
Right. And any last comments? We have like about 30 seconds or so.
Oh, okay. Well, we are having a meeting October 24th, and if people, providers, would like to attend, they can call 508-862-7811 to RSVP.
And Ron, we'll put a link up to on your website, on our website, capeandislands.org, because I know you've got a lot of reference material. If people are seeing some symptoms and they want to know where they can go,
sure.
We'll put a link up.
Great.
And thank you all. Ron Holmes, Executive Director of NAMI Cape Cod and the Islands. Diane Wolfsifer, psychiatric nurse practitioner at the Cape Cod Health Care Center, ER, and Liz Kelly, nurse manager of the Emergency Center. Thank you all.
And thank you, Mindy.
Thank you, Mindy.
Feel your frustration. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.